Introduction, 1963. Like two massive weather fronts colliding over America's heartland, the decades of the 1950s and 1960s seemed to run headlong into one another in 1963, creating huge and violent thunderheads. The innocence and tranquility of one era was turning into the raw, wild turbulence of another. As January 1963 dawned, movie theaters were showing The Manchurian Candidate, a late 1962 political thriller starring Frank Sinatra, Lawrence Harvey, Janet Leigh, and Angela Lansbury. The plot revolved around the son of a prominent right-wing political family who had been captured during the Korean War, brainwashed, and sent back to America to eventually assassinate a presidential candidate. In Hollywood, film editors were completing work on the first James Bond movie, Dr. No, starring Sean Connery, as a British MI5 agent with a license to kill. Elsewhere in Hollywood, writer Rod Serling was completing a screenplay of Fletcher Nebel's political novel, 7 Days in May, about a coup attempt in the United States, destined for a 1964 release. Violence and political intrigue were in the air, part of life in this new decade, and not just in fiction. In February 1963, French authorities arrested 5 people and charged them with plotting to assassinate President Charles de Gaulle. A rifle with a telescopic sight was found in the apartment of one of the alleged conspirators. It was not the first attempt on the French president's life after he had earned the fury of conservative French leaders for allowing Algeria to gain its independence. In America, President John F. Kennedy was hoping the third year of his presidency would be a bit more tranquil. In his State of the Union message to Congress, Kennedy laid out a case for what he said would overshadow all domestic problems in 1963. No, not civil rights, but a tax cut to stimulate the economy. However, civil rights was a problem that would not wait. African Americans, particularly in the South, were no longer willing to tolerate violence, abuse, and second-class treatment. They marched for equality and the free and unfettered right to vote. In May, Kennedy was forced to send federal troops to Birmingham, Alabama, after a protest march against the state's segregation policies erupted in violence. Civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King dismissed the administration actions as too little, too late. Black Muslim leader Malcolm X, meanwhile, denounced Kennedy personally for doing too little to support the cause of justice in the South. Instead of attacking the Ku Klux Klan and White Citizens Council, Kennedy attacked Islam, a religion, Malcolm X said. The violence continued. The following month, civil rights leader Medgar Evers was shot and killed by a sniper as he arrived at his Jackson, Mississippi home. 10 days before his assassination, Evers, perhaps sensing the violence that surrounded him, said, "If I die, it will be for a good cause." Evers' shocking death sparked more rioting in the South. At the University of Alabama, Kennedy was forced to send federal troops in once again to protect 2 African-American students as they registered at the all-white state university. Kennedy may have believed he was moving on civil rights as quickly as he could, but black leaders like Dr. King clearly didn't have the same view. In part to pressure the president, King called for a march on Washington in August, drawing a multiracial crowd of 250,000 at the Lincoln Memorial. There, King stepped before microphones and stirred the conscience of a nation. "We cannot turn back," King declared. "There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, 'When will you be satisfied?' We can never be satisfied as long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote, and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." And then King summoned the soaring, inspirational, and optimistic words that changed the political landscape of 1963 and peered into the future.
I have a dream that one day,
my poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
President Kennedy watched the speech on television at the White House. Later, he greeted King in the Oval Office with the words, "I have a dream." If Kennedy was truly moved by King's rhetoric, he was still enough of a political pragmatist to realize that real change would take time, and King and his fellow civil rights leaders might not be willing to give it to him. Civil rights was taking over the political agenda in 1963, much against Kennedy's wishes. And his long-sought tax cut, requested again in January, still eluded him. Maybe he could still achieve them both. First, however, he would have to get reelected.